True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
During the 1940s, TAN took hundreds, maybe thousands of babies from their birth mothers, mostly women who were poor or uneducated and so couldn't fight back. And then she would place the babies with childless couples who would pay up to thousands of dollars. TAN told those parents the money was just to cover expenses. But in truth, most of the money went into Georgia TAN's pocket.
TAN printed slick brochures to advertise the children. At holiday time, she'd plant newspaper stories offering Christmas babies available for adoption. She shipped babies from coast to coast on late-night flights, and then would distribute the babies to waiting parents in the lobby of a hotel. She provided children to Hollywood celebrities like June Allison, and Joan Crawford got her twin girls from TAN, too. TAN's baby business grew, and she needed more and more children. And so she turned to her good friend, a juvenile court judge named Camille Kelly, who was well-connected in Memphis city government.
She had a stooge down in the welfare department when someone would apply for assistance because of they'd lost the job. This person would get their name and get in touch with Camille Kelly. Camille Kelly would send a deputy out, pick them up, take them back, award custody to Georgia TAN, and Georgia TAN would sell them. They were gone before you could do much.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick. Good evening.
Alma Sipple, a single mother in Tennessee, could not afford medical care for her 10-month-old daughter, Irma, when a knock on the door changed her life forever. There stood a woman with close-cropped gray hair, round wireless glasses, and a stern, broad face. The older woman exuded authority as she explained she was a social worker and the director of a local orphanage. She'd come to help. Alma was relieved and excitedly rushed to show the lady her sickly child. Examining the baby, the woman offered to pass her off as her own at the local hospital in order to obtain free treatment. She warned Alma not to accompany her, explaining, "If the nurses know you're the mother, they'll charge you." So lifting the child from the bed, the woman turned and disappeared. 2 days later, Alma was told that her baby had died. In reality, Irma had been flown to Ohio and adopted by a wealthy couple there. Alma would not see her daughter again for 45 years. Far from being the kind savior that Alma thought she was, the woman who'd taken Irma was a baby thief. For years, Georgia TAN made millions of dollars selling children. A network of scouts, corrupt judges, and politicians helped her steal babies and young children. She targeted school children on their way home from school, promising them ice cream and tempting them away from their homes. Legal papers would be signed saying that they were abandoned. Most would never see their families again. Now, it is estimated that over 100 children died while in Georgia TAN's custody at the Tennessee Children's Home, victims of malnutrition, a lack of medical care, neglect, and even abuse. Many children simply disappeared, and we don't know what happened to them. These crimes against children and families are remembered as one of the most sordid chapters in American history. The degree of cruelty and corruption is difficult to grasp.
I would say flabbergasted, for want of a better term, at how this lady was allowed to work for such a long time.
I know, the corruption is just astounding. Oh,
and I guess you say, well, it was a simpler time in a sense. And we didn't look at people with as much scrutiny as we do these days. But still, you know, I'm just absolutely awestruck.
Yes, because it went beyond neglect. There was some severe abuse, even murder.
Yeah, there was just horrific things going on with this woman.
Absolutely. And not just her. I mean, she couldn't work alone. She had
no,
help.
No, she had help.
She did. So join us at the quiet end. We're going to discuss the families victimized by the Tennessee Children's Home. And we'll talk about the corruption that allowed kidnapping, illegal adoption, and child abuse to thrive in our country for 30 years. In this episode of True Crime Brewery, The Baby Thief. What do we have for a beer? Something from Tennessee, I would guess.
Something brewed by Wiseacre Brewing in Memphis, which is the city we're discussing.
Nice.
So the name of this beer is Astronaut Status. Now, this is an American Double or Imperial Stout. I keep revisiting these kinds of beers. I think it's because those were the ones I liked the most.
Okay.
But anyway, just to refresh people, these stouts are inspired by the Russian Imperial Stout, sort of the grandfather of all stouts. They are likely to be barrel-aged, either in bourbon or whiskey barrels. They can have coffee or chocolate added to them, and they typically have a big amount of alcohol. Now, this particular one, Astronaut Status, measures in at 10.5%, which is certainly healthy, not as big as some of the ones we've had, but big enough.
Big enough, yes.
This beer is their basic stout that's aged in bourbon barrels for 11 months, and then before bottling, cinnamon sticks and vanilla are added to the beer. And a lot of beers do that. A lot of stouts are made this way now, barrel-aged with cinnamon and vanilla. Makes for a very nice stout.
Yes.
This is no exception. I love this beer. A very dark brown color, almost black. Got kind of a mocha-colored head and a good amount of lacing. It's got a chocolate and bourbon aroma.
Nice.
And some vanilla. And then the taste is exactly as you'd expect from the aroma. A lot of chocolate, a lot of bourbon, some vanilla. And the cinnamon sneaks in more on the taste. I didn't notice it as much on the aroma, but it's certainly there on the taste. This is a sweet beer, a little bit on the spicy side, which I think could be either from the alcohol or from the cinnamon. Gives you a little burn there. Very nice.
A nice burn, okay. Well, let's get to it. I'm ready to open it.
Okay, let's do that. So we'll take these guys down to the quiet end, sip them, because they're meant to be sipped.
Well, yes, we want to be able to talk.
Right. And I'm looking.
Yeah.
There's Ascot Guy, formerly known as Gold Chain Guy.
Uh-huh.
But he doesn't have either of those now.
Wow.
And look, it seems he has a date.
Nice.
There's a very nice-looking woman talking with him.
Yeah, and she's not wearing an ascot either.
Or gold chains.
No.
Now, I'm going to take credit for this.
You are? Why?
Yeah.
What'd you do?
Well, he and I got talking a few times ago.
Yeah.
And I said to him, you know, you're a reasonably good-looking guy. You can have a conversation without sounding like an idiot.
Uh-huh.
You don't need those affectations like an ascot or a bunch of gold chains. I said, just be yourself.
Nice, yeah.
So I think maybe that's what's happening.
And you told him of your dapper ways.
Well, no, I didn't try to use any self-examples.
All right. Because many times you're just a t-shirt and jeans guy anyway.
Right.
Which is better than an ascot also, I guess.
Well, I would think.
Okay.
But it seems like he's doing okay.
Well, very good. Congratulations, Dick. Good job.
Just a little teaching.
If you could bring a little joy to a life, that's all you could ask for.
That's me.
Right.
The quiet end Santa Claus. That's what they call me.
Nice. Very good. Well, I'm proud to be married to you then. Georgia Tan arranged over 5,000 adoptions between 1924 and 1950. Many of the children were kidnapped. She molested little girls in her care and had no problem adopting children out to pedophiles.
Well, she adopted children out to anybody who would pay her. She did zero screening of adoptive parents. I mean,
yes.
It didn't matter to her as long as she sold the kids.
You had to have the money.
Yep.
Yeah. She caused so many child deaths that the infant mortality rate in Memphis became the highest in the country. And the deaths were actually more because many of the children's deaths went unreported. Now, many weren't buried in the cemetery and their bodies were never found. The children who did survive were adopted by wealthy people all over the U.S. Many of them did love their adopted children, but some would use them as domestic servants and farmhands. Many of these children were starved, beaten, and sexually assaulted. Now, Memphis was ripe for exploitation when Georgia became involved in adoptions.
Yeah, the yellow fever epidemic had killed hundreds of people in the late 1800s. Yellow fever can be a pretty nasty infection. It's a viral infection spread by mosquitoes, and it was a big problem. I remember reading that when they were building the Panama Canal, a lot of the workers contracted yellow fever, and there was a high mortality rate.
So is this before we had DEET?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
And it's before they got really into mosquito control. So, but there was a lot of deaths from it. Many people in Memphis left the city for good, and it became a city of transients. The few remaining citizens who had financial means withdrew to certain areas. And the poor newcomers lived in tenements near the business district. Criminals flourished and the homicide rate climbed. So you could almost say that the yellow fever paved the way for Georgia. Adults were much more likely to die than children. It's because it could be more of a self-limited infection in kids, but adults were more likely to get pretty severe liver disease and end up with liver failure and death.
Wow, okay.
So a lot of kids were orphaned.
Hundreds, I think.
A lot.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of gratitude for the nuns who cared for these orphans, and they gave the Memphis citizenry an undying respect for women involved with adoption.
So people were looking up to these nuns and women that were caring for these orphaned children at the time.
Right. It was like they're doing God's work.
Right. Yeah. So they're almost like Mother Teresa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this continued into the 20s when Georgia began her work at the Tennessee Children's Home. So the altered demographics in Memphis, what with a lot of adults dying, produced a lot of single moms whose babies were Georgia's to steal.
Yes, they were so vulnerable.
They were, because they're single mothers. They have little money, right?
Yep.
And a lot of times there's more than one child. It's tough caring for a passel of kids with little money.
Right, and so, this was before there were as many resources and services.
Right.
It's before the New Deal. So let's go back into history a little bit of Georgia, what made her who she was, which was a monster. She was born in Hickory, Mississippi in 1891 to the most prominent family in town. She was the daughter of George C. Tan, a district court judge, and Beulah Yates Tan. Now, she grew up in the nicest house in this small town, which was just 75 miles to the east of Jackson. The interest that her father took in orphans and foundlings through the operation of his court led her into child welfare work. Now, she worked in adoptions in Mississippi and Texas before moving to Memphis.
So, just a little question here. Her birth name was something Beulah George Tan or something?
Yeah, both of her parents' names.
Yeah, but she took the name Georgia.
They called her Georgia from childhood.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting that we had both parents' names in there.
Yeah, right. Well, her father was respected in town, but he was not well-liked. He was arrogant, he was controlling, he was also known as a big womanizer in town. He'd leave town to see women, or he'd even bring them into his office in the middle of the day to have sex with them. And he made no efforts to hide his infidelities. In fact, he seemed to think he deserved any woman he wanted. He was a little bit proud of it. Now, Judge Tan was emotionally cold and insensitive with his family, but inexplicably, he became known for finding homes for children. He often came across them in his court. They were abandoned or removed from their families due to various legal and social difficulties.
And I'm thinking that some of George's problems as an adult definitely stem from her upbringing. Here's a father who's cold and distant, who feels like he can get away with anything because he's rich and powerful.
And that's much how she turns
and
out.
That's what she turns out to be. She learned at the knee of a great teacher.
Well, I think we'll learn that she was really trying to get her father's attention and respect because it was lacking in her life.
The respect.
The approval.
Approval.
Anything that a kid wants from her parent.
Yeah. So Judge Tan kept and adopted a homeless child who became George's brother, Rob Roy.
Rob Roy Tan.
Wow. Now, he was 3 years older than Georgia. Relatives said that Georgia was named after both her parents because George didn't want to give his name to an adopted child. Now, Rob was different from the rest of the Tan family, thinner, more prone to sickness. He died of tuberculosis at age 46. Now, most people found him to be a warmer, more likable Tan than the rest of the family.
Yes, that was the word. Rob had been his mother's favorite, though, and Georgia was a daddy's girl. Now, she seemed to have found a way to connect with her father by helping him with these arranged adoptions. In 1906, when she was only 15, she arranged her first adoption. It was of two young children she found huddled in the corner of her father's courtroom. They had been placed in the protection of the Mississippi Children's Home Society, and they would be placed in an orphanage. Within 3 weeks, Georgia had persuaded a respected Mississippi couple to adopt the 5-year-old boy and 3-year-old girl, And in an interview with the Memphis Press, Georgia described the biological father as a man with a mean disposition and the mother as a dull woman from an ordinary poor family. Years later, she bragged that the children grew up to get college degrees. So, before we get into anything else, we can certainly say she was a snob. She looked down upon the poor people.
She did. And you can see in her later life that she thought she was doing these children a favor by placing them with people that she thought would at least give a better life than they would be expected to have if they stayed with the parents.
Yeah, but only the prime children, if they were good-looking, intelligent,
right.
If they had anything wrong with them, she really did not care about them at all.
No, she didn't.
She might let them die, kill them, abuse them, put them to work, whatever. They were like property to her.
That's all they were. She was successful with this first one. If the story later on that they went to college is true, these kids might have done okay for themselves.
Well, I'm sure there were some kids that did okay.
And did. Do we know? I mean, they were taken from the parents, so they were going to be in an orphanage and be adopted out anyway.
Yeah, so these were, she escalated as time went on. This wasn't necessarily as unethical as she would become.
Right.
Right.
These were. This was still working within the boundaries of the law.
Yes, exactly. Now, as she grew up, Georgia and her father did become estranged. Now, it may have been related to her failure to conform to the expectations of Southern womanhood at the time. Georgia had no interest in marriage, and she wanted to pursue a career. She was a large woman with masculine features, and she preferred flannel shirts to dresses. As a child, Georgia was very active and loved to play outdoors, but she was forced to spend hours inside practicing piano. Now, to become a lawyer in the early 1900s, you had to read law with a practicing attorney. Georgia read law with her father and passed the state bar exam in Mississippi, but he wouldn't allow her to practice because she was a woman and the only girl in the family, and this was considered inappropriate. Women were still considered intellectually inferior and were expected to marry and have children. If they were to have a career, it would be teaching or nursing. Even women who were homosexual or wanted to remain single would usually end up getting married because they had no way of supporting themselves. Lesbians during this time sometimes had romantic and sexual friendships with other women, but it wasn't easy. It was always hidden.
Had to be.
Yeah.
But independent young women could expand their options through education at women's colleges, right?
Right.
So Georgia graduated from Martha Washington College and remained single. Crushes between young women were accepted there. Many female professors lived in what were called Boston marriages, which were domestic and other love partnerships with other women. They wore rings and they called each other sister. Now, Georgia followed this practice with her partner, Ann Hollingsworth.
And they were a long-term couple.
A very long-term couple.
Right. I wonder why they called them Boston marriages. Any idea? I couldn't find that anywhere in the research.
Maybe.
It's interesting.
Maybe. Women's colleges in Boston were the initiation of these kinds of things?
That's true. You might be right about that. That would make sense. Well, she majored in music, and she taught briefly in Columbus, Mississippi. After that, she took a job with the state's first orphanage, the Mississippi Children's Home Finding Society. She found homes for orphans, despite a culture that wasn't sold on the idea of adoption. Social work was a fairly new profession. Georgia may have begun her work with adoption, motivated by altruism, but she began depersonalizing the people she helped very early on in her career. Now, that could be a self-protective mechanism, but it seems like she took it a little too far.
Oh, for sure, she did. And her coldness was encouraged by Southern culture. They looked down not only on black people, but on the white people.
The poor white people, yeah.
Yep. She was businesslike and never seemed to have any favorites among the children. She did end up adopting one girl herself, but she was an emotionally cold woman, and the girl ended up being raised by the maids.
Yes, the girl would go on later to say she really had no relationship with Georgia.
No.
And maybe she was just adopted as a publicity thing, just to say, oh yes, I've adopted a child.
Well, yeah, because as you said, the idea of adoption at that time in Mississippi was not received really in a good manner.
No, I don't think anywhere in the U.S. it really wasn't a popular thing to do back then.
So if you're pushing for adoptions, it would certainly help if you have an adopted child of your own.
Right, exactly. Well, if she was cold to the babies and the children, She was actually disdainful toward the young poor mothers of the children that she stole. She would confide to people that she saw the world with two widely divergent types of people. Poor people, including the single mothers, were bad. She referred to these women as cows or breeders. Then there were the wealthy people who she described as of the higher type. She would argue that poor people were incapable of proper parenting. Their children needed to be rescued from them. She would save them by taking them and placing them for adoption. So here's her philosophy in a nutshell.
Exactly.
Which is pretty sick.
Yeah. Well, think about Nazi Germany and stuff. I mean, this is all the same kind of thing.
It's very similar, yeah. You know, instead of race, they're just using wealth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, in 1922, Georgia drove out to the Jasper County home of a poor young widow whose name was Rose Harvey. Rose had diabetes, and she was asleep inside when Georgia arrived. Now, diabetes in the early 20s, that's going to be a fatal illness for her.
Yes.
Insulin hadn't even been discovered yet. Now, her son, Rose's son, was a robust and adorable two-year-old named Onyx, and he was playing on the front porch. Georgia scooped him up, took him back to her father's court. Father declared Rose an unfit mother. Georgia placed Onyx with a new family. Then she went back to get Onyx's three-year-old brother, who was also placed with a new family.
Two different families, so the boys were separated.
Boom. Quick job.
Right. So the adoptions of the Harvey children were alarming to the citizens of Jasper County. Judge Tan seemed to be indulging his daughter's passion for taking children from the poor and placing them with the wealthy. He had connections in Memphis, a big city, and Georgia moved there to take a job with the Memphis branch of the Tennessee Children's Home Society. She couldn't have gotten this job without the approval of the city's political boss, Edward Hull Crump, and he was known around town as Boss Crump.
Now, Boss Crump kind of reminds me of Boss Tweed in New York. I guess that's what they called the bosses.
I guess so,
the,
yeah.
The leaders. Boss Crump had come to Memphis at the age of 18 in 1892. Now, like Georgia, he was from a small town in Mississippi. He saw a city still finding its footing after the yellow fever outbreaks, and he thought that he could become a leader of the city. And he was. By 1910, he was mayor. He was a very charismatic leader, which I guess you have to be to run the place.
I would think so, yep.
For decades, he would control city and state elections. Crump machine ran from the mayor's office until he didn't need it anymore, and then he had a personal office. His supporters were given city jobs in exchange for campaigning and voting for his candidates. And they were also expected to kick back a portion of their salaries to his campaign war chest. Gambling organizers and madams who ran houses of prostitution paid into the war chest also. While most southern mayors oppressed black citizens, Crump built parks in their neighborhoods and brought new voters into his camp.
He must have been fairly smart.
I'm sure he was.
Yeah.
He was a very intelligent, powerful guy. So he used his people to do maintenance, repairs of city property. He had men to intimidate opponents and solidify his statewide power base. Because he didn't just run Memphis. He was pretty much running the state.
Yeah, by the time we got into the 1900s, he'd expanded.
Yeah. And by the 1940s, he had put up candidates in over 100 political races. And had won every single one of those.
Now, the influence there is really staggering, to have that much influence.
No kidding.
If power causes corruption, you can see how this happened.
Uh-huh.
Right. So whether it's due to her father's influence or her own ingenuity, Georgia found herself right in the middle of this Crump machine. As she worked to change the city's opinions on adoption, she focused on winning over the Memphis elite. She sold legislators and their wives on the idea of having a precious new baby in their lives. Now, as soon as a request was made, Georgia would just pop up with the baby. There was no screening for abuse or for parental fitness. Boss Crump's cousin got a child from Georgia, as did the new mayor of Memphis. Judges, state representatives, and senators adopted through Georgia.
So she's building a pretty impressive power base here.
Absolutely, yes.
Finding children for the elite of Memphis society.
Big business.
Right. Now, finding homes for institutionalized and homeless kids could have been Georgia's career. but she wasn't going to be satisfied with that. She became obsessed with finding adoptive homes for children who already had families and homes. So we're starting to cross the line a little bit, or maybe more than a little bit.
Yeah, well, the line is a pretty thick line you don't want to cross, I would imagine. Well, when a member of the state delegation was waiting on his grandchild to be born, the child was stillborn, and he called Georgia Tan for a replacement newborn. The switch was made before the new mother awoke from anesthesia, and no one ever told her that her baby had died. So the mother of the replacement baby, we wonder what happened to her. They probably told her that her baby had died.
Oh, yeah, right?
I would imagine. So there were people in the hospital. There were just so many people that had to be going along with this for it to work.
Like I said, it's mind-boggling.
It is, yeah. Pretty scary.
Georgia felt she was taking children from trashy people and elevating their lives. She often boasted of placing children with higher-type adoptive parents, and she expected the birth parents to be comforted by that. Yeah, fat chance.
I know, right?
Where'd my baby go?
Well, it's just so judgmental.
And Georgia equated affluence with happiness. So, to her thinking, the end justifies the means.
Well, I can see to a certain extent that having more money makes it easier and can make a child's life better. But we don't know who these people are. You can't predict what's going to happen to a poor family. They might do better. They might be more loving. And just the whole judgment of it is sick. It's real sick.
It certainly is. I mean, she's just deciding on her own, basically.
Kind of playing God, yeah.
Yeah.
She seemed to believe this even in cases where she killed a child. A child who would die as a result of her social engineering would at least not have to grow up poor, was her thought. And of course, the satisfaction of making poor children middle class or wealthy wasn't the only benefit of her career. She became wealthy. She became influential. She was on a first-name basis with the prominent people who adopted her children, which expanded to movie stars, directors, producers, politicians, you name it.
Right. She was a big fixture in Hollywood.
Yeah, really the only show in town.
For adoptions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the country.
Right. Now, she was a smart woman.
Very shrewd.
She employed a guy named Abe Waldauer as her attorney. In Memphis, Waldauer was extremely well-connected, and he was proven to be an effective ally in lobbying the Tennessee General Assembly. So he was very sympathetic to Georgia, because he was an adoptive father himself. Her first contact with Abe Waldauer most likely was in 1933, when she wanted the lawyer's help with her invalid brother. Georgia Tan wrote a petulant letter to Waldauer in January of 1933, complaining, "I have tried several times recently to see you and talk to you in regard to my brother's claim against the government."
Right. Now, eventually, though, Waldauer became both Georgia Tan's personal attorney and that of the Tennessee Children's Home Society. The board of Tennessee Children's Home Society included some of the best people, I say that in quotation marks, in Memphis. Walter Chandler would go on to serve as congressman from the district, as well as mayor of Memphis. John Reichman was a former Shelby County sheriff, and Mrs. E.W. Hale was the wife of the head of the Shelby County Commission. So the famous author Pearl Buck even wished to collaborate on a book with Georgia Tan. Yet these people knew exactly what Georgia was doing, and she enjoyed their personal protection. It was unlikely that she fooled everybody. There had to be some consent there.
Right. But she did fool a lot of people for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
So she helped to formulate the laws on adoption in Tennessee, some of which exist even today. Due to the nature of her business, it was imperative to Georgia that adoption records remain confidential and closed. She was secretive, and there were instances where she even deceived her own lawyer. Now, she would contact Judge Kelly with a list of changes in Tennessee laws which she believed needed to be changed. She'd send the list on her own stationery to Abe Waldauer, the attorney, which gave him the idea that these changes were being requested by Judge Kelly and the Shelby County Family Court.
Well, that's pretty sneaky.
That's a nice end around, isn't it?
It is. Now, some of the children given up or sold for adoption by Georgia were fortunate enough to find loving homes, but there were many who were far less lucky. There were numerous stories of birth parents and mothers who literally spent their entire lives trying to locate their lost children. Now, Georgia conceived this idea of placing ads in local newspapers complete with a photograph of the child, freshly bathed and nicely dressed, under the headline, "Want a Real Live Christmas Present?" Another featured a smiling little boy grasping a ball under the headline, "Yours for the Asking." Now this ad read, "George wants to play catch but needs a daddy to complete the team. Catch this ball, Daddy. How would you like to have this handsome 5-year-old to play catch with you? How would you like his chubby arms to slip around your neck and give you a bear-like hug? His name is George, and he may be yours for the asking if you hurry along your request. In cooperation with Miss Georgia Tan of the Tennessee Children's Home Society, the Press Scimitar will place 25 babies for adoption this Christmas."
And it's like you're putting a puppy up for sale.
Yeah, you know? I even find it a little bit offensive for a puppy. But right. For children, it's obscene.
Oh, God. But the newspapers thought they were rendering a real service to the children. They were helping to find them a loving home.
That's true. I could see how you might think that. If you didn't know how corrupt it was, if you thought that these were children that really needed homes and that she was getting them legally, you might say, well, this is a way to find them a home.
Those are some ifs that you put in there, though.
Well, sure. Those would have to be true. But then I think that back then people didn't screen people or look at them as skeptically as we do now.
No.
Not at all.
Not in the least.
I mean, if someone was married and had a good job and, you know, did well in society, we just assumed they were good people back then.
Exactly.
That's the way it worked.
And if you were a big shot in Hollywood, well, that of course that makes you a good person.
Well, yeah, then you're just wonderful. But we know better now, I hope.
We do. So Georgia began to expand her adoption services to the national scene. She got celebrity clients from Los Angeles and New York. She got babies for Lana Turner, Dick Powell and June Allison, and twins for Joan Crawford. And we know how well Joan Crawford's kids worked out.
Well, yeah, that's the Mommy Dearest movie, right? And she was very abusive.
Yeah.
Those kids had a horrible time.
Right.
So there's higher type person there.
Higher type person who didn't have any screening or anything done.
Right.
But I suspect even if she had been screened or even if they had known of her ill temper or mental illness, whatever she had, she still would have gotten the twins.
Yeah, but there should have been some type of assessment afterwards as well, which I believe there is nowadays, where you go and check in.
Yeah.
See how it's going.
Well, you have to.
Talk to the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they didn't even do that back then.
Not at all.
So these celebrity names are from the past, but in today's terms, these celebrities would be on par with Brad Pitt, George Clooney, Julia Roberts. I mean, these were big names in the time,
These were big, big stars. That's right.
And then Georgia even began placing babies overseas. She had successfully ended the national stigma of child adoption, and it was now a popular thing to do.
So I guess there's a positive finding in all this.
A little bit, yeah.
Small.
Right, that's something.
But it was also an enormously profitable business.
And I would think that the profits were more of the motivation for her.
Yeah, of course they were.
Than changing the way people looked at adoption.
Yeah, it was. So, by adopting children out of state, Georgia was able to charge obscene amounts of money for travel expenses. By the late 40s, she was placing 90% of her children outside of the state of Tennessee. She rode around in a limo. She'd restored her family home in Hickory. She added fountains and imported palm trees. First person in town to have a refrigerator.
She was very wealthy.
Very wealthy woman.
Mm-hmm.
Even a millionaire.
Now, as she became more successful and more in demand, her real problem was inventory, right? Because she's got no shortage of homes to send these kids to.
Right. But there
and
is
no scruples about where they go.
None.
She just needs more of them.
We need more babies or right. more kids.
No, right.
Not just babies.
No, but babies were more popular.
Sure.
And a little bit easier to steal because she had these techniques of stealing them from mothers under anesthesia or from unwed mothers who were ashamed. She was very sneaky about it. And she became more creative and aggressive in getting the babies from these poor people. The Crump machine helped her out enormously, of course. Police would ignore biological parents' complaints once their children were kidnapped. Judges terminated parental rights whenever she requested. City workers created false birth certificates with the adoptive parents listed as the birth parents. Now, I can hardly imagine that my child is kidnapped. I go to the police, and they won't help me.
And nothing gets done.
And then if you go to Georgia Tan, she says you should be thankful. They're getting a better home. You can't provide for them like these people can. Holy shit.
Exactly.
It's stunning.
It is. And Crump machine legislators changed adoption laws to enable Georgia to operate. The secrecy in the adoption process was increased. National clients became involved in shielding her from investigation and regulation. The adoptive parents often feared that Georgia would tell the birth parents where their kids were, and they feared losing the children they'd become attached to and loved.
Well, she was a smart woman, you know. She would wait until they were attached to these kids, and then they're going to do anything to keep them.
Well, yeah.
So then if they expose her, they're going to get, maybe lose their child. So, I mean, she's working it in every single direction, manipulating everybody in the whole thing.
She's a very shrewd woman.
She is. Now, like Judge Kelly, Georgia was actually praised by unsuspecting populations for what was most believed to be her good work. National publications referred to her as the foremost leader in adoption laws in the country. Eleanor Roosevelt actually sought her advice on issues regarding child welfare, and President Harry Truman invited her to his inauguration. If anything, Georgia Tan was outwardly respectable, so no one would have suspected what a horrible monster she was.
Not at all. And her alliance with Judge Kelly gave Georgia enormous power. She was not only armed with the power of the court, she also had the resources at her command from the Memphis Police Department and the Shelby County's Sheriff's Office through Judge Kelly. Now, there's probably good reason to believe that Judge Kelly was paid for her cooperation in all this.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Right. Why else would she do it? I mean, she might have had the idea that these adoptions were good, but she had to be getting some money.
Yes, had to be. Even if she started out not doing it, once she sees how successful Georgia's business is, she probably would want a cut of that, too.
Sure.
So.
So I'm going to tell a little story about one of the baby thefts that really affected me that I heard about. This was really a crazy story.
It is. But you know what?
What?
It's not that different of a story in Georgia Tan's life.
Oh, no, this was a usual thing.
This is one of the common things.
Absolutely.
Maybe the magnitude of it is a little excessive, but this is how Georgia worked.
Right. So. This is just an example of her modus operandi.
Mm-hmm.
So on a sweltering day in the summer of 1939, two women working for Georgia Tan arrived at the home of widow and mother of six, Grace Gribble. Mr. Gribble had worked on the railroad and was killed in a work-related accident 3 years earlier in 1936. Grace had received a small settlement, but six children between ages of 3 to 10 were very expensive and difficult to feed and clothe on her own. Now, she'd gotten help from the state welfare agency before, and the two women, Mrs. Sims and Mrs. Rose, were sitting in her living room asking her questions. They were filling out a form for her, which they told her was an application for free medical aid from the Widow's Assistance Program. Now, she presented the pages for Grace to sign. Grace was relieved to be getting assistance for her family, and she eagerly signed the six pages that Mrs. Rose presented to her. And then Mrs. Rose folded the papers, stood up, and said, "I'll take the three youngest now." So Grace, as you can imagine, was shocked.
Yeah, she's thinking she just found a way to help the family survive financially.
Uh-huh.
And now she's learning that she signed away all six of her kids.
And she was familiar with Mrs. Rose, so she wasn't a complete stranger. So she had reason to be trusting her. So when Grace realized what had happened and what she had just signed, she screamed. She just surrendered all six of her children for adoption. That was it. Now, she cried hysterically. She ran after the women who had already taken her three youngest children out of the house, and they were walking with them towards Georgia Tan's limousine. Mrs. Rose had her four-year-old boy, Kirby, in her arms, and she told Mrs. Gribble, "We have an order for a boy of just his age and type," as if this was to be a consolation to her.
Yeah, right.
It's so cruel. Now, Grace thought the women might be at the courthouse trying to finalize these adoptions, so she made her way downtown, which wasn't an easy thing. She had no car. And Georgia Tan was in the courthouse. Now, Georgia was a very imposing figure, they say. Speaking with a frightening confidence, she told Grace that her children were on their way to a better life, and that it was a better life than she could ever provide for them. And she gave this bit of advice to Grace. "Forget them," she said. But, of course, Grace would never forget her children.
No, she wouldn't. But even if she had tried to go through legal maneuvers to get her kids back, she wouldn't have been able to.
No, everyone's on the other side.
Right. Georgia has everyone on her payroll or working for her. So the police department wouldn't be able to help. The sheriff's department wouldn't help. The court wouldn't help. She's screwed.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, her conspirators in legal circles and politics had to be aware of her illegal methods for getting these babies and children and adopting them out. But we don't know if they were aware of really how heinous the abuse was and how many of the children suffered terribly at the hands of her and the people that worked for her.
Her practice was to rid herself of babies put in her charge who she deemed unsaleable by leaving them unattended out in the sun until they suffered hyperthermia and died.
Basically broiled to death.
Yes, I guess. That's too grisly a term.
Well, I think we need to be grisly here because it's a horrible, grisly thing. Why make it pretty?
I wasn't making it pretty. I was just not saying broiled to death.
Well, I mean, it's a horrible thing. They were pretty much baked.
Georgia and her lover and the male sexual deviants she employed would beat and torture children just for the perverse sexual thrill of it.
So this is a part that a lot of people aren't aware of. A lot of people think, yes, she stole children from the poor. She broke laws. But it was more than that.
Yeah.
It was horrible.
And this is what eventually is going to get her shut down. Just is going to take forever.
Right.
To do it. But I guess you're a person looking to adopt a child. You can overlook the methods she's using, but it would be tough to overlook child abuse.
Well, yes, it definitely would. I mean, according to one surviving victim, Georgia and her companion would hit the children on the scalp so no one would see the bruises. Favored forms of child torture at the home included tying a rope around a child's wrists and hanging that child on a coat rack and dangling a child from a rope down the laundry chute. And if they just happened to die from this, they got rid of the body.
They did. So bodies would pile up. Witnesses near the home said that they had seen staff burning the remains of these dead infants and children on the Tan property. So it's believed that the bodies or cremains of nearly 500 children are scattered throughout the former orphanage's grounds. There's another statistic that just chills me.
Yeah, we don't really know, but that's what they think.
Upwards of 500 kids.
That's what they think. There were at least 100 that they knew of, and then there were all the ones that disappeared. And, of course, the records weren't great, so yeah. There's no way to know exactly.
Weren't great, probably non-existent.
Right.
So the best-looking children got to be sold off to the wealthy and may have had a better life than if they hadn't been separated from their poor biological families. Well, we don't know that, but they did have more money.
Well, I mean, there had to be a few that were better off.
Sure.
But we don't know how many.
And the children who weren't placed in permanent homes got to suffer at the hands of Georgia and her staff at the children's home.
Yeah.
So, great situation.
So I'm going to take a second. We have a sponsor. Going to the salon can be a real luxury, but we know how expensive and time-consuming it is. It takes a couple hours, a couple $100s. Sometimes I really don't like to spend the time or the money. Now, I'd been coloring my hair at the salon for years, and I honestly never believed I would color my hair at home again. But that was before Madison Reed entered my life, and I started getting great color while saving time and money. Now, Madison Reed is revolutionizing the way we color our hair with the ultimate hair color hack, the quality of salon color with the convenience and affordability we can all really get behind. Join me in getting multidimensional hair color from Italy delivered to your home on your schedule for under $25. Find your perfect shade at madison-reed.com. Madison Reed is honoring our True Crime Brewery listeners with 10% off and free shipping on your first color kit with promo code BREWERY. That's madison-reed.com and use the promo code BREWERY to get your 10% off and free shipping.
Yeah, they do a good product. So, back to the case. When babies or children would become ill, Georgia wasn't always willing to get them the medical attention or medication that they needed. She sometimes found it preferable to let them die. Certainly, if they were undesirable, she didn't want the expense of caring for them. And any sick children could be easily replaced, in her opinion. The women who worked in the home were complicit in the abuse and the murders of innocent children. They helped dispose of the bodies of literally dozens of children.
And I just wonder, where did these women come from? Would you think there'd be that many women that would go along with this heinous crime? I've always thought of women as the protectors of children, for the most part.
Yeah.
I mean, I know there are a few bad ones, but maybe. I just wonder where she got these people.
Maybe they were well compensated, although I doubt it.
I don't think a lot of women couldn't be compensated enough, or a lot of people, not just women.
Yeah.
I mean, this goes beyond anything that money would make you do.
She had a lot of power over people, for whatever reason, I don't know.
Well, that's true, but still, it's unimaginable to me.
Me too. So Georgia also had the local Thompson Brothers funeral home cremate some of the children. It seemed to be a good way to get rid of evidence. Deaths were easily preventable. Many died from starvation, dehydration, gastrointestinal illness, or respiratory infections.
Yeah, so a lot of them died from dysentery and just dehydration from diarrhea.
Yeah.
And not being fed right.
I mean,
how quickly can a baby die from dehydration?
Fairly quickly. I mean, obviously, the smaller you are, the quicker you can get sick and die.
Right.
And back in those days, gastrointestinal illnesses were very common. They still are pretty common, but, you know, the sanitation was such that the GI diseases could show up almost any time, run through a whole household, a whole city.
And I would imagine that the locations where she was keeping the children were disease-infested anyway.
Right.
I mean, the sanitation there was not good.
Yeah, and if you decide that this was a undesirable kid, you just didn't do anything, and the kid would die.
That's awful.
And if it was a desirable kid, you gave them fluids and they would recover.
Yeah, maybe. Charles Cart, a pediatrician who volunteered his services to the home in the 1940s, was extremely concerned by Georgia's overriding his orders for a sick infant in her care. He'd prescribed penicillin, and he later learned that she'd ordered her nurses to stop administering the medication, but to continue charting it as if it was given. Now, she didn't listen to doctors unless it was convenient for her. She always thought that she knew best. The common practice in the 1930s and 40s was to hospitalize full-term infants for a week and preterm babies until they weighed over 5 pounds. So why was that? That's just to make sure that they're eating properly, or?
Yeah. I mean, the 5 pound is a kind of a magic number. So if you can eat and gain weight and get to 5 pounds, say starting off at 3 pounds or 4 pounds, you're okay to go.
Now, the full term stayed for a week. Now we know nowadays it's usually just a couple days. But
I mean, this was back in the day.
Yeah, and I'm sure there wasn't the follow-up. And there must have been more risks because moms didn't get antibiotics as often.
Oh, there's a host of things.
I mean, this is the 30s and 40s. What were things that women died of and babies died of back then that they don't really now?
Well, postpartum sepsis, group B strep, was a big baby killer, and just a host of GI illnesses.
So if you kept them for a week and watched them, that was probably a good idea.
Yeah, at least in the sense that if there was some disease communicated at birth, like group B strep, and they made it a week without showing signs, they would be okay. Except there's also late onset group B strep, but that's another discussion.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's a term baby who was in good health for the first week of life, ready to go home.
Well, Georgia sometimes took children away only a few hours after birth. She'd get the mothers to sign papers while they're still under the anesthesia, and of course she didn't want to leave them there and wait around. So she'd quickly transport them to adoptive homes that were sometimes thousands of miles away. Babies would arrive at their new homes with fevers and dehydrated, and of course some of them died after that journey.
Well, yeah. So there was one infant girl sent to New Jersey who died hours after her arrival. Now, this couple had previously received a child with a heart defect from Georgia. Not to defend Georgia, but heart defects don't always get picked up right at birth.
Well, no.
So maybe she was unaware of the heart defect.
Well, she probably was.
But the poor health of many of the children Georgia adopted out was such a well-known fact that a Memphis hospital reserved an entire ward for their care. Holy cow.
Now there's a big shining red flag, huh?
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, and here's another one. There's a hospital in Los Angeles that also maintained a ward for many of the sick babies she sent to the local celebrity adoptive parents.
While physicians did complain about Georgia to the Department of Public Welfare and the state director of the Tennessee Children's Home Society, but no one did anything, and she continued to hurt and kill babies and children. It's just nothing happened.
Yeah. Now, I'm amazed. I mean, that seems like you're getting higher up on the food chain, and that complaints such as were lodged by the physicians would have been listened to more thoroughly, but apparently not.
Well, that just shows the scope of the corruption to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I can see that they ignored the poor parents.
She's pretty high up.
Yeah, but now they're ignoring other people as well as the parents, health professionals, physicians, nurses.
Yeah.
Even celebrities must have had some complaints.
Right.
Well, in 1932, the city had the highest recorded infant death rate of any U.S. city. Now, this was 8 years after Georgia had first arrived in Memphis. And over the next 2 years, the recorded Memphis infant mortality rate continued to climb. And, of course, the true number is unknown, because she didn't report nearly all of the deaths.
You know, I just find that so difficult to grasp in my head, that she had enough babies die under her watch that it had the highest death rate of any U.S. city. That's just insane.
It climbed rapidly.
Yeah.
And it's not like it was ignored. People did look into it, but nothing was done.
No. U.S. Children's Bureau sent someone to investigate in the mid-30s, 1935. The investigator found that the striking difference in deaths in Memphis versus other cities was the number of deaths from gastrointestinal disease among white infants.
Now, we know she only dealt with white children.
Yeah, well, because besides everything else, she was a racist.
Yeah, probably pretty severe racist. Now, what about this gastrointestinal disease? Why are so many kids dying from it? Dehydration?
Yeah.
Which could probably be simply treated.
It could be.
If she just would have hospitalized them and listened to the doctors.
Right.
These are preventable things.
These are largely preventable things. And so I have to think that a lot of the deaths were neglect.
Yeah.
With the onset of the GI disease, vomiting, diarrhea, not being treated because they were the undesirable kids that wouldn't be able to be adopted out.
Yeah, or so, just easily replaceable. I mean, they were really just commodities to her.
They were.
Yeah, it's just horrific. Now, the investigator's search for facts was quashed by Georgia's lying. In 1935, she said that no child had died in the Tennessee Children's Home since the beginning of the calendar year. Her truthfulness was scrutinized, of course. She was also criticized for taking babies from hospitals and maternity residences earlier than the doctors had recommended. But why was she allowed to continue doing
it? But nothing got done.
No.
She also kept babies in unregulated boarding homes.
Yeah, this part really blew my mind.
Yeah, exactly. 9 of the 10 boarding homes that were investigated turned out to be overcrowded. One two-room apartment housed 10 children. In another apartment, 6 infants shared one crib. And just,
So the filth, you can see why they would get sick.
A third home had no refrigeration and newborns were being fed spoiled milk. Well, no wonder all the GI diseases were happening.
Yeah, so sad.
In 2 other boarding homes, one kid had tuberculosis and another had congenital syphilis. Georgia refused to allow the medical treatment.
Now, tuberculosis, isn't that highly contagious?
Quite a bit.
So, if a baby has tuberculosis, they can be giving it to the other babies and children.
In the household.
The workers who can spread it to other homes.
Easily, yep.
So that's, like, terrible.
And even the kid with syphilis doesn't have to be spread only by sexual transmission, so they're contagious too.
Okay. Well, 16 more children had lived in an attic of a house that the fire department had actually condemned as a fire trap. And 2-year-old twins, this one really breaks my heart. 2-year-old twins were found living with a 72-year-old woman who was blind and too senile to remember their names. She addressed these babies as old man and old lady, and she fed them pieces of bread and sugar water. And this makes me almost cry. This is so heartbreaking.
It's just the way she worked.
Yeah, you know? But just to imagine that.
And probably things were even worse than get described.
You think so?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is just what they found out about.
Right.
But that's just pathetic, really pathetic. She was using most of the commercial boarding homes in Tennessee, and none of them were licensed, of course. But Georgia was so influential that people were afraid to mention her name in the newspaper articles that were published. In fact, Georgia and her attorney responded angrily to articles published in the Tennessee Public Record. Abe Waldauer wrote several letters to the Commissioner of Public Welfare, William Schoaf, complaining. So that's takes some balls, huh? That's nervy.
Yeah, you know, like, so what? I know they're unlicensed, but we're doing a good thing.
Yeah, I know. It's hard to imagine.
But, see, we're starting to get to the wind-down of Georgia's reign. By the 1940s, some uncomfortable questions were being asked. Georgia owned valuable property, including a motel, a large farm, and home named Tanwood, and was driven about town in a chauffeured Cadillac limousine. Evidently, folks were encouraged to believe Georgia came from a prominent and wealthy Mississippi family, so fewer eyebrows were raised than might have been the case otherwise.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of people thought she'd inherited the money.
Because after all, she's a social worker, basically. That's what she's portraying herself as.
Yes.
And social workers didn't have the means to be driven around in a chauffeured limo.
No, he was actually had a hat and a uniform. It was a fancy car.
Yeah.
Now, in 1945, the ethical social workers, which were the vast majority, celebrated legislature that was passed mandating the licensing and inspection of every children's boarding home in Tennessee. But Georgia had clout, and she worked to include a new subsection to that law. So any boarding home used by her agency was made exempt from the law. Can you believe that?
That's a really good way to squash the investigation, isn't it?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
And you can look at this from a political aspect or any other way, but, I mean, at the heart of it, children are continuing to suffer and die because this is going on.
And still nothing gets done. Or where they do something and it gets circumvented.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah. Now, children also continued to die in her home on Poplar Avenue. So this was the home she'd opened in 1943. Conditions there, they said, were possibly worse than in the boarding residences. And we heard from those examples how horrible things were in the boarding homes. Things might have been worse there. I don't know how it could be worse, but...
I don't either, but it could be.
Yeah.
The heat was unbearable in the summer, said Miss Leon Sims. She worked in the house through 1943. It was particularly hard on the children with fevers. Georgia called Miss Sims and the other caretakers nurses, although none of them were trained nurses. Miss Sims says, I'm the only person on duty at night, and I care for as many as 25 children. Everyone needed attention, but I didn't have enough time. A lot of illness. Main problem was diarrhea. Well, we've talked about that, how highly contagious it is. And you've got upwards of 25 kids in a home.
Well, and once they have diarrhea, they're not getting their diaper changed. I mean, we're already in a cloth diaper era.
Right.
So how often are they really getting a clean diaper or any kind of skin care? So, I mean, couldn't they get septic from the diarrhea if they get skin breakdown and their skin opens up?
Of course.
So that's a horrible way to die. And, of course, the GI illnesses were very serious, the gastrointestinal illnesses.
Yeah. I mean, babies are small to begin with, and they can get dehydrated fairly quickly. And there was a particularly severe epidemic of the disease in Georgia's home in 1945 that caused the deaths of 40 to 50 children in under 4 months.
That's a significant amount of children.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
I mean, it's a large amount of people. Yeah. So this was despite the efforts of the pediatrician Clyde Croswell, who said he urged her to hospitalize her sick infants and to stop admitting new infants into the orphanage because the diseases were spreading. But she just ignored him. Now, after complaining to Georgia, who insisted that only 2 children had died, now I don't know how she gets away with that. If she's hiding the other bodies.
I mean, where are the bodies?
Yeah. Dr. Croswell met with her attorney, Abe Waldauer, and other members of the board of directors, trying to make a change here and have something done about this. I can't imagine, as a pediatrician, how seeing this would be. Must have been really hard.
It must have been not only hard, but extremely frustrating, because you're reporting these instances of abuse that resulted in deaths, plural, and nothing happens.
And you're giving her the tools to prevent it.
Yep.
And she's not using them.
Dr. Croswell offered to show them a list of children who had died, but they didn't want to see it. The board members, board of director members. After that, six other Memphis doctors complained to probate judge Samuel Bates, whose court had long officiated over George's adoptions. In May of 1946, Judge Bates wrote a six-page single-space letter to the commissioner of the Tennessee Department of Public Welfare detailing the doctor's complaints. Maybe we're getting somewhere, huh?
You might think so.
The letter expressed concern over the dysentery epidemic, that's the gastrointestinal illness, that has killed at least 40 children. It also expressed concern over George's failure to screen adoptive parents, the advertisement of particular children up for adoption, and George's failure to follow up and assess the care children were receiving in their adoptive homes. All kinds of things we take for granted these days.
Yeah. Now, Dr. C.E. James, who had an office in the Methodist Hospital, he said that babies were released to the Tennessee Children's Home that were born at the hospital, and they would leave in perfect health. And then many times they would return and they'd be emaciated, like they weren't being fed. Many of them died as a result of neglect. He recalled a time where a child was given to adoptive parents, but then only lived 2 weeks after that.
Mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Dr. Croswell stated that he had advised Georgia many times not to bring babies out of the hospital before they weighed at least 5 pounds, but she repeatedly disregarded his advice. According to Croswell, Georgia had a woman assistant who frequently came on duty in an inebriated condition. Croswell had secured the services of a registered nurse and tried to put her in charge of the babies, but Georgia would not permit it, and the nurse left.
Yeah, she must have been.
So,
I mean, that would be a hard position to be in because you'd want to help the kids, but it really would be impossible for you to do that, so you just leave, but then you'd have to feel horrible leaving. Can't imagine what that decision must have been like.
Yeah.
Now, the attorney Abe Waldauer and board members grilled the doctors and issued their charges were groundless and false from beginning to end.
Yes, but Judge Bates was less intimidated by Georgia than his predecessors had been, so he stopped approving her adoptions.
Hallelujah.
Yeah, but this didn't stop Georgia, as she and her attorney simply spoke to judges in rural Tennessee counties. And these small-town judges weren't even lawyers, but many were politically savvy, and they did as Georgia asked. So once again, she's circumventing some rulings.
But at least there are more things she has to circumvent.
Yeah. I mean, as we're going through this, we're starting to sense that her reign is coming to an end.
Yeah, but it took way too long.
Way too long. Can't even begin to describe how way too long it was.
Yeah, right. George's ability to continue to operate, even after Judge Bates and the physician's complaints, was, of course, due to her connection to Boss Crump. Unfortunately, she was also enabled by the general belief that adoptable children were more expendable than other children. Now, much of her success depended on her newspaper ads, and when the Christmas baby ads became syndicated across the country, they did get disapproval from Charles C. Carsons. Now, he was the executive director of the Child Welfare League of America, and he sent a warning to Georgia to stop placing the ad. When she persisted in placing the ads, she and the Tennessee Children's Home Society were expelled from the league, from the Child Welfare League.
Georgia claimed she hadn't been expelled, but had voluntarily withdrawn because of disagreements and attitude. And then she went even further by making children perform for the prospective parents. And then she allowed people to buy children as gifts.
Yeah, how outrageous is this?
Yeah. So one person could go to Georgia, get a child, and give the child to someone else to raise.
Like buying someone a puppy or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she also allowed couples to take 2 or 3 children on trial, allowing them a year to decide which child they'd like to keep and return any other ones.
Yeah, it's terrible. Now, Abe Waldauer often referred to the children as products. So he wrote to a prospective client once, "It's not often that we have the good luck that we have in your case, namely of having the merchandise in hand and in stock to deliver to you immediately." And then he offered a 1-year money-back guarantee for any unhappy clients. I wonder how someone as despicable as Georgia found someone as despicable as him, and then they partnered up to make just a horrific pair of people.
I guess like breeds like or something.
It caused a lot of damage. I mean, not just in Tennessee, but all over the country.
All over.
Yeah. And George's clients did often send children back, often because they weren't as intellectually gifted as they'd been led to expect. Now, the pain of these rejected children, what they must have felt, was totally irrelevant to Georgia. When one adopted girl got scoliosis, she said that her mother was furious, and she told the girl, "Hey, I spent a lot of money on you, and you're a big disappointment."
Just what you want to hear.
Now, the vast majority of adoptive parents were decent people who would keep the children they adopted, so Georgia didn't really worry about this liberal return policy. I mean, it was more quantity over quality that she was dealing with here.
Right. And after all, we're just dealing with a commodity.
Right.
We're not dealing with
people's lives.
Right.
Yeah.
Joy Barner grew up knowing that she was a disappointment to her parents, but she didn't know that she was adopted or that she had been bought to replace a dead birth child. When she was 7, she opened an old family trunk and learned about the dead daughter. There were dainty little frilly dresses in the trunk. When she asked her mother if they were hers, she was told, "No, they were your sister's. She's dead. Don't ever mention her again. You don't have dresses like that because you're plain." So Joy spent the rest of her childhood knowing that she was inadequate, had been purchased for $500, and wasn't worth it.
I can't imagine what that does to a child's self-esteem, sense of security, everything just destroyed.
Your whole psyche is screwed.
Yeah. Barbara Davidson, who was molested by both Georgia Tan and her adopted father, was frequently beaten while she lived in the Tennessee Children's Home. She was so traumatized that as an adult, she had to have anesthesia just to have simple procedures like the teeth cleaning.
There's so many stories of abuse and so many people who suffered because of Georgia Tan. She was financially successful, but she was not emotionally stable. Well, that's not a big surprise.
No, of course not. But people thought she was.
Yeah, sure. Her
people
appearance
she,
was.
She looked upstanding. She looked all like she had it together. But she really didn't.
Not at all.
I mean, that goes to just back up my comments about you don't know. You can't judge people by the outside.
No, you can't.
No.
So she might have been financially successful, but was not an emotionally stable woman. Her partner, Anne, described a couple breakdowns, nervous breakdowns, in 1933 and 1934. She also medically was unwell. She'd had 2 heart attacks, and she had a limp after being in a car accident.
Yeah, so eventually, not even Crump could stop the letters of complaint about her. They were pouring in from all over the country. Abe Waldauer dealt with most adoptive parents' complaints by threatening to cancel their adoptions. So that had worked in the past. By 1945, her practices were widely criticized, though, by ethical social workers. And a bill that would require her to assess the qualifications of adoptive parents reached the legislature. She busily blackmailed clients into sending telegrams opposing the bill. And the bill was defeated. So once again, Georgia wins.
Georgia wins again.
She has a secret meeting with the Crump-appointed legislators, and the bill fails. So, I mean, she still has a lot of clout. Even in the mid-1940s, she was still wielding a lot of power.
She's been doing this for 20 years or so now.
Mm-hmm.
But finally, 1948, Boss Crump's guys lost. So we had outsider candidates for governor and senator, and they won their state elections. Now we're getting somewhere. The new governor soon agreed to shut down the Tennessee Children's Home and launched an investigation. However, he was only interested in her financial fraud.
Yeah, it seemed that the people in high places in Tennessee wanted Georgia shut down, but they weren't really eager to unseal these adoption records. I'm sure
no.
A lot of people were afraid of what would happen.
Well, can't you believe that?
Absolutely, well, I can, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Now, she was debilitated by cancer and was confined to her bed by August of 1950. It was in 1951 that the state completed its investigation into the allegations against the orphanage. But by then, it was already too late to press formal charges against Georgia Tan, because she died in September of 1950 of uterine cancer. Now, her death came just 3 days after she'd been exposed in some news articles, so she never really had to deal with any public shame. She died surrounded by family and friends, a much kinder death than those she abused and killed. Adoptive parents all over the country worried that their adoptions would be nullified, but that didn't happen. A Tennessee law was passed legalizing all of her illegal adoptions. I'm not sure how I feel about that. I can kind of feel for the adoptive parents, but I don't know if that was really the right thing to do, because there's still all these kids that shouldn't have been taken from their parents.
Exactly. But I'll tell you what, it was the expedient thing to do.
Well, yeah, it would have taken years and years, right?
So let's just pretend that everything was done legally.
Well, a lot of the people that have grown up and found their parents, but it's taken them 30, 40 years, some of them.
Years and years.
Yeah. So Georgia really had won again, unfortunately. She slipped away without being held accountable for her crimes. And when she died, though, there was very little money left. She'd gone on spending sprees, and she didn't leave anything behind. All she left behind was a terrible legacy for adoption, and she left behind generations of suffering, of course.
She sure did. So adoption in America, I think you're going to talk about that, but through Georgia's influence, adoptions were closed and secretive. Now, in Europe, adoptees are allowed access to their original birth certificates. Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Israel, China, and Japan all give adoptees access. But we're in America, we're moving away from that.
Well, yeah, closed adoption does still exist, though, along with open adoption. The International Association of Adopted People does not support any form of closed adoption. It's considered detrimental to the psychological well-being of the child, but it does still exist.
It does, but it's on the way out.
I hope so. I mean, it's been a long time, though. We're 2017 now, and it still exists, so it's taking a long time to overcome what she set up.
Right. And Georgia had such a successful business, and that's what it was, that she had imitators.
Well, yeah.
There have been brokers who began operations after Georgia, following in her lead. There's a team very similar to that of Georgia and the juvenile court judge Kelly, who worked in Augusta, Georgia. And there, a probation officer reported the names of babies born to poor parents to a juvenile court judge who would terminate the rights of both birth parents. They then sold the children to couples in California and New York. The probation officer also got newborns by telling mothers their babies had been stillborn. Shades of Georgia.
Yeah, that's for sure. There was another baby seller in Wichita, Kansas, who was reported to have kept pregnant women on cots in her basement, and then she allowed clients to come in and choose the woman whose child they wanted to buy once it was born.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they are like cattle.
They are. This is just something I don't even want to hear about.
Well, the thing is,
a horrible thing.
Yeah, so when I first heard about Georgia Tan, I really didn't realize the horror. I mean, I knew that it was horrible. She stole babies and adopted them out illegally and stuff, but I didn't know about all the deaths or the abuse or the horror of it, really.
No, I mean, that's I don't want to say fascinating, macabre.
Yeah.
And this is something that isn't that well known.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's a really horrible and, in many ways, little known for most people.
Yeah.
History.
I mean, it's started almost 100 years ago. So
right.
That's part of it. But still, it's just, to me, overwhelming.
Yeah, I'm surprised it's not more well known. And I hope that some people who didn't know about it have learned about it from this episode. Because I think it's an important part of history to remember so that we don't repeat it. Which a lot of history does repeat itself.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'd like to take a minute before we go to feedback to talk about what's happening at Tigrabber. We have a change coming up on September 1st for our new subscribers. So beginning on September 1st, we will only have two levels of payment for Team Tigrabber. We're going to have $3 a month and $5 a month. The $3 a month subscribers will still get a bottle opener, and the $5 a month subscribers will still get a snifter. But everyone will get a sticker as well. And also access, of course, will be the same. And no need to worry, though, if you're already a $2 a month subscriber. All of you will be grandfathered in, and you can stay at $2 for the, at least for the foreseeable future. We don't have any plans to change that.
No.
I mean, everybody's already signed up. We're going to keep that.
Yeah, we're not kicking you out.
So if you want the $2 a month, you need to do it this week, because we're not going to have that anymore starting September 1st.
So get your $2 bids in.
Or wait.
Or wait.
Now, speaking of Team Tigrabber, the third episode in our series on the O.J. Simpson trial was released last week, and we've gotten some really nice feedback on it, and it's so appreciated. I love to hear about it, not just good things, but I like to hear what people are thinking. So part four is going to be out in a couple of weeks, and at that point I'm going to announce what we have in store for our next members-only episode. and I'm pretty sure it's going to be something less well-known. I'm a little overwhelmed with the information, and it's a well-known case.
Just the sheer volume of info.
Right.
It is
overwhelming.
Amazing.
Even spreading out in four episodes, you really can't get to everything.
No. I'll bet we could have done a dozen episodes and still not get to everything.
Yeah, well, I'm not doing that. I'm pretty OJ'd out.
Yep.
So suggestions for that next members-only episode are definitely encouraged if you want to get those into us. If you haven't joined TieGrabber, it's an easy thing to do. You just go to tiegrabber.com/teamperks and sign up with PayPal. Now, we also have a brewery shop on our website where you can purchase t-shirts, beer glasses, bottle openers, and coasters. And there's also an absolutely free way for you to give us some support. The next time you're shopping Amazon, please just go in through our link on tiegrabber.com, and then Amazon will give us a tiny kickback from your purchases. And these are things you're going to buy anyway. We won't know what you bought, and the prices won't change at all. So this is just really a great way to support the podcast. Just make that little bit of effort without having to put out any cash. Now, if you have feedback for us, you can contact us at truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com, on Twitter at tiegrabberpods, on Instagram at tiegrabberpodcasts, or on Facebook. Some of our listeners have started a True Crime Brewery discussions group where you can chat about cases we've covered, cases you'd like us to cover, anything true crime, really. It's also a great place to give us some constructive criticism. We're well aware that we aren't perfect, and it's really important to us to continue to improve, because our main goal here is to not only have fun talking about true crime and drinking beer, but give our listeners things they want to hear. And as always, I just want to say we're very appreciative for all you do.
We certainly are.
All right, let's have a little bit of music, and then we'll do our feedback.
Ready.
Get some good stuff from listeners today.
Okay.
Welcome to Feedback.
So I'm going to lead off.
Okay.
I have a suggestion from Stephanie, who says, I would love if you could cover the Bitter Blood murders that involve Susie Sharp. It's an amazing story.
Okay.
Now, there's a book called Bitter Blood by an author, Jerry Bledsoe, that covers this. It's a true story of Southern family pride, madness, and multiple murder. Sounds interesting.
It sounds really good. I was looking at that, yeah.
So 30-some years ago, Susie Newsome and her husband, Tom Lynch, get divorced. There's a bitter custody battle over their two sons. Shortly after the finalization of the divorce and the beginning of their power struggles, Susie became intimate with her first cousin, Fritz Klenner. Now, Fritz Klenner was a gun-worshipping doctor with a long history of dishonesty. Turns out he was a fraud, never went to college or med school. So,
yeah, I love these kind of cases.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to buy that book on Kindle and we'll read that.
Let's look it up.
Okay. So I have a letter from Jamie Lynn. It's about Taken, William Terrell. And Jamie says, foster parents either killed him by accident or he died while neglected by the foster parents. They drove 4 hours unexpectedly. Then the father drives to the nearest town to get phone coverage. William disappears in a very short and impossible window of time. Foster parents do renovations to the house after disappearance and flat out refuse to speak or show their grief on camera, no matter what legal matters are in place, since a child has gone missing in your care, all caps. Police are following the wrong scenario. It explains why no one has snatched the $1 million reward. This has gone on too long. Time for a new detective with a new set of fresh eyes on the case. Now, I have to admit I was stunned. I didn't even realize he was a foster child. I guess this was just released this year.
Yeah, I remember when we were researching it, they didn't name the parents.
No, they said there was a legal reason why they couldn't reveal them, but
right.
We didn't know they were foster parents.
See, that's an interesting comment.
So William, just to refresh memories a little bit, he's 3 years old and he went missing about 3 years ago. and it turns out he was a foster child. Now, at the time William disappeared from the house in Kendall, he was under the control of the Department of Family Community Services, being cared for by these foster parents, and that's referred to as out-of-home care. This was a secret guarded until recently, when the ACA revealed that these foster parents were taking care of him. But that's another missing piece in the puzzle, and it's really captured the country of Australia, I guess, this new information.
Yeah. Well, it suggests that there's some hiding of facts or something.
I guess. And Jamie Lynn seems to think so, but according to the articles I've read, there's no suggestion that either William's biological or foster parents were involved in his disappearance or know where his whereabouts are. Now, I guess if you don't trust the detectives on the case, you're not going to trust that. And I don't know enough to say either way. But it's just a new piece of information to think about in this case.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
So I have a note from Haley regarding Forsaken.
That's the Susan Smith. Yeah.
And her comment is, I wonder if that whole thing about the saying, baby, I gotta go, but you're gonna be okay, I love you all, exactly what she said to her kids before she drowned them.
So that's what she told police she said to the kids before she rolled them into the water. I wouldn't be surprised if she said that. I mean, my hope was that they were asleep and didn't even wake up, but that doesn't seem likely. It seems like they suffered.
It does.
Yeah. Well, I have one from Gayla, and she says she has a theory about the Lisa Irwin case, which was Gone Baby. That's a fairly recent case. She says, a theory about why she disappeared. What if someone saw baby Lisa's mother drinking day after day and thought that she was a terrible mother? One day that person says enough is enough and took the baby while everyone was asleep. What do you think of that theory? You know what case we're talking about.
I guess it's plausible, but far-fetched to me.
Well, it's possible, yeah.
I mean, that would have to be someone who's familiar with the family.
Yes, right.
Who sees the amount of alcohol that the mom drinks.
Right.
And makes up her mind that she's going to remove the baby from the home.
Well, I think what Gayla's doing here is trying to be optimistic. She says, I'm just hoping Lisa's alive and happy.
Okay.
So if someone took the baby because she thought the parents sucked, and now she's in a better home, that would be a great outcome.
That would be.
I mean, in our eyes, right? Maybe not in the parents' eyes, but
well,
it might be.
And we don't want to sound like Georgia Tan.
No. But we're not talking about money here. We're talking about possible alcoholism and neglect.
Well,
possible. Yeah.
I'm thinking I'm not buying it, but it's a possible thing.
It's a thought, as they say.
Yeah.
So what have you got?
I got an email from Dan O'Connell. Planning evidence exceedingly rare? Dick, go to Baltimore. You seem terrific, but OMG, what an ignorant statement. I don't even know where to begin. When you Google planting evidence, there are over 31 million hits. Planting evidence is what lazy cops have relied on for a century.
Okay, so what do you think of
that? I think that still, it is a rare event.
Okay, well, now, you looked into it, and what did you find out?
That it's a rare event.
Okay.
But now, certainly, there's high-profile cases. Dan mentions the Baltimore evidence, and they're going to throw out a ton of arrests because of the cops planting evidence, and they're caught on tape doing it. So there's no question. Or also the chemist who worked in the lab in Massachusetts who would fictionalize evidence. There's a whole bunch of cases being thrown out, but I think those are more the exceptions.
But when they do happen, they make the news.
When they do happen, it's big news.
Right.
So I agree that there is evidence planting, but I still think it's a fairly rare event.
I think
most cops are hardworking, honest police.
I was thinking it's easier to plant drugs on people, and that's, I think, what they were doing in the Baltimore case.
Right.
Or weapons.
But
planting a victim's blood, I think, would be a lot harder.
Sure. Right.
I would think. Yeah. I have no evidence for that. But
no, I think that's a lot more difficult.
Okay. That's my thought on it. So Yama sent a message, and he said about the postpartum psychosis Andrea Yates case. He said, I would call this one postpartum fucking retarded husband and the priest.
Agreed.
Okay. Thought that was funny.
That's all I'll say about that.
Okay.
And along with that, Blondie B4BC, also on the same case, Sometimes the side effects of medication can be worse than the actual mental illness or even make things worse. And I would not disagree with that statement either.
Yeah.
But still, you try to treat.
Well, yeah, you have to continue trying.
Yeah.
But I think the whole point here with Andrea Yates was she shouldn't have been left with those children alone. That's the common sense of it.
Right, isn't it?
She obviously wasn't well.
And it was apparent
well. I mean, the psychologist that first saw her said she was the sickest person she'd ever seen. So I do blame the husband a lot. He kept wanting her to have kids and left her alone with those kids.
Yeah.
He probably didn't purposely do anything, but it was just stupid. So I have a comment from KLH on Getting Away with Murder, which is the Kaylee Anthony case. And KLH disagrees with our assessments on the jury in the Casey Anthony trial. So KLH says, I disagree with both of your assessments that criticize the jury. You should instead be looking at the prosecution, their refusal to listen to reason, and overcharge anyway. It's not the jury's job to draw inferences and to overlook contradicting experts for the same side. That in itself defines reasonable doubt. If the state's medical experts conflicted, or if believing one negated the other's scenario, then the jury's instructed to go on their opinion of credibility. This wasn't a less-than-sharp jury. This was an arrogant prosecution that thought destroying the defendant's character would be enough to fill in the holes where evidence should have been, and thank God for that. The jury isn't supposed to see the forest and ignore the trees. The trees are the facts, and the details that were insufficient to charge her beyond doubt, and it's unreasonable for you to expect the jury to do the state's job. They were let down by the prosecution, and the defense did an outstanding job creating reasonable doubt. So the jury got it right. Their hands were tied. So, KLH, I think I still disagree with you. I don't think the jury got it right. I think they fell for a lot of the things that the defense was making up, like this whole George idea that George had molested her and all this. There was no basis for that. And I think maybe the jury does need to see the forest for the trees, maybe not ignore the trees, but you do have to see the big picture. So I respect what you're saying. You've got some good points, but I still disagree. How do you feel?
Well, I think that I would agree with her assessment that the prosecution was arrogant. I think they figured they just had to show up and get a conviction.
Well, the guy whose book we read was arrogant, and I can't think of his name right now, one of the attorneys.
Right.
He was clearly arrogant and maybe a little overconfident.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think that they underestimated the defense, and the defense team did a really good job of casting doubt. Now, having said that, I don't think there were inferences that the jury ignored. I think there was a succession of facts that weren't being able to be put together by the jury.
Like an example?
Well, the cadaver dog picking up the decomposed body in the trunk of her car.
Yeah, yeah. Although, weren't they claiming that maybe she was in the car, but George had taken her?
I don't recall.
Would still be a fact. I think that was their whole thing, was to blame George.
And the duct tape. I don't know what KLH's problems with that. How it was discovered.
Well, there was that guy that worked for the power lines or whatever.
Right.
And he hadn't called the first time. I can't remember the details,
yeah.
But there was some sketchiness with him. I would agree with that.
A little bit, but
But I can't see any reason why he would place duct tape there. There's nothing to... And the DNA on the duct tape.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think that the jury could have been able to look at what was presented as evidence and arrive at a guilty verdict.
Yeah, I agree. But yeah, KLH does have some points.
Oh, definitely. 1969 Narcissus has a suggestion. Would be great to hear you do the Jeffrey McDonald case. Thank you for these. Now, we've talked about that. This is a really famous murder. A Green Beret who was convicted of killing his wife and children and claimed that the house had been overrun by satanic hippies.
Yeah, this is the one that The Fugitive was loosely based on. He's a doctor? Or is he? No, this is a different one.
This is a different one.
Okay, I'm
mixed
up. The
Fugitive was based on the Sam Shepard case.
That's the one I'm thinking of.
This is an army guy in Fort Bragg where his family was killed and he was slightly wounded. And he was convicted of the murder. And this has been going on for years.
And he's in prison.
He's in prison.
Okay.
There's been appeals. Nothing's come of it. But it's a fascinating case. And I would be happy to do it.
Okay.
I even have the book.
Yeah, and I think there was recently a special about it on...
With some...
The People Investigates
some
or something.
Some purported new information about
it. Okay.
But it's a good story. Just as an aside, the guy who wrote the book, Joe McGinnis, was initially brought on to make a case for his innocence, but came to believe that he was guilty. And the book is really written so that you believe that McDonald's guilty.
Oh.
So he looks at McGinnis as a double-crossing rat.
I bet, yeah. That would be a bummer. You've got someone to proclaim your innocence and they change their mind.
Yeah.
So it'd be interesting to see what he based that on. I'd be interested in reading about that.
Okay. It's right over there in that bookcase.
Okie dokie. So I have a comment from Michelle on the Jodi Arias fatal exposure episode. I think she grabbed the bed sheets off the bed in a rush, not realizing her camera was all bundled up in it. Because I think it was his camera anyway. I've been wondering about why the camera was in the washing machine, and that's what makes the most sense to me. So that I think that's a good idea. That could
that,
be...
That makes the most sense to me.
Yeah, that's a possibility.
Because you're not going to just toss the camera in the washing machine in an attempt to get rid of the information on it.
Well, I always wondered why she thought that would work. So if she didn't realize it was in there, she could have been a little bit frantic when she did it. So I would believe that.
I would too.
Yeah.
And Patricia, also about the Jodi Arias case, wants to know why Arias is being allowed to sell her so-called art.
And she is. I looked it up. She has a website. At first she was selling on eBay, and now she has a website to sell her art.
She has a dedicated website.
Let's not advertise it for her.
Okay, but she's asking as much as $8,500.
And getting it.
Well, yeah.
So this reminds me of the laws they made back with the Son of Sam case, that criminals weren't supposed to be allowed to make money.
Right.
Although this isn't directly off the case, but that's the only way that people know of her.
It is.
So.
Oh, I don't know what the loophole is.
I guess there's no law to prevent it, Patricia. She's just allowed to do it. I would suggest that we shouldn't buy any, because she doesn't deserve to make any money. So Patricia wrote again, and this one she wrote was about the murder of Rachel O'Reilly. She said, only 12 years for premeditated murder. That isn't justice. It's an insult. So this is Rachel O'Reilly's husband, Joe, beat her to death with some weights and only got 12 years. And what we learned is that in Ireland, they don't get quite as many years in prison. So he only got 12 years. And yeah, I don't think that's long enough either. I agree.
No, we agree fully.
Yeah.
I have a suggestion from Eric. It would be very interesting to hear your take on the Michael Bargo case. So this is a case in Florida, I guess. Yes, it is. 15-year-old Seth Jackson was beat, shot, and tortured by four teenagers. And they burned his body in a backyard fire pit, placed his remains in 3 5-gallon paint buckets, and dumped them at the bottom of a lime rock pit. So they had four kids, young adults, and this guy Bargo was the trigger man and mastermind behind the murder plot.
When did this happen?
This happened in 2011.
Oh, it's fairly recent.
Fairly recent.
Okay.
So let's look into that.
Put that in the to-do pile.
Okay.
Okay, so I have a letter from Cranky Babushka on A Mom on Death Row. That's the Darlie Routier case, the woman who they think killed her two young sons and said it was a home invader. Cranky Babushka says, I'm not saying she didn't do it, but I've looked into the murder and I really didn't like how the trial went. That video the prosecution used to incite the jury. Now, that would be the video with the silly string where the family seemed to be having like a party at the graveside.
At the graveside.
Again, not saying she didn't do it. I just don't like shifty lawyers. I agree.
Well, we would agree we don't like shifty lawyers.
Well, yeah. I don't know if they were shifty or not, though. I'm pretty convinced she did it. But I know you have a longer one about the case, so I'll let you go.
I am. Because, you know, we've maybe not been chastised, but just about chastised for our viewpoint that she did it. We've had somebody who we would consider a Darlie supporter.
Well, there's quite a few out there.
Write to us.
Yeah.
So I have a letter from Brian regarding the Mom on Death Row, Darlie.
Okay.
So this goes on, and I'm sorry, this is a little bit lengthy, but it's a good letter. So, to the Darlie supporters, no one wants to believe a mother could murder her children. especially a pretty young mother who on the outside gave the appearance of being an attentive mom who wanted nothing but the best for her children. The jurors that were interviewed after the verdict said they went into deliberation wanting to find something to show her innocence. They just couldn't find it. Darlie Rudier denies her guilt. When interviewed, she knows exactly how and when to cry and turn on the heart-tugging emotions, and people eat this up. These very same people turn a blind eye to the very evidence that convicted her, or they simply say the crime scene processing was tainted and botched up. Anytime a trial verdict doesn't go the way someone wanted it to, they say the system failed. The people who believe Darlie Rudier was wrongly found guilty, a.k.a. the Darlie supporters, try their best to fit the evidence to their preconceived conclusion of innocence. If it doesn't fit, they'll make it fit, even to the level of absurdity. If you look at all the various websites that include reader comments sections, you'll find that approximately 90% of the Darlie supporters are female. It appears that women have more trouble accepting the fact that a woman could possibly do such a horrendous thing to her children than men do. Ironically, in the state of Texas, 83% of past filicide cases, which is parents murdering children, were committed by the mother. In Texas alone, in the past 21 years, a total of 23 mothers have murdered 44 children. Darlie supporters love to direct people to an old CBS 2020 special taped 18 years ago in 1999, hosted by moderator Sylvia Chase. They featured juror Charlie Sanford stating he was incorrect in his guilty verdict. However, he has since recanted his opinion. And Sylvia Chase states the defense was never given the entire Silly String video, including the memorial service conducted before the spraying of the Silly String. Now, her statement is totally untrue. Darlie's lead defense attorney, Doug Mulder, has even stated that they did receive the entire video, and for reasons unknown, decided not to present it to the jury, or object to the memorial service not being shown to the jury by the prosecution. Darlie supporters claim that the police and the prosecution both intimidated and coerced witnesses, that the crime scene forensic procedures and evidence was mishandled, that investigators destroyed and even covered up evidence of the mysterious intruder, that they coerced the hospital staff into changing their testimony, that they even say the crime scene photos presented in court were manipulated. Then they say the judge slept through the trial, that certain defense witnesses weren't allowed to testify, that transcript errors were responsible for determining the outcome. They even blame the judiciary laws of the state of Texas. Most of the Darlie supporters have trouble convincing themselves or anyone else that an intruder actually entered the house. They cannot support that argument with absolutely no evidence found to suggest that anyone came in the house or exited the house. The only argument left would have to be that either the district attorney's office and the police intentionally framed Darlie, or Darlie's husband Darren, who is the only other adult already in the house, must have done it. In recent years, some of the Darlie supporters have in fact convinced themselves that Darren Rudier murdered his sons. They point out that he lied in his written statements and that he lied in his court testimony, which in several instances it appears that he did. Obviously not very familiar with the case, many of Darlie's supporters raise questions as to why the police and the prosecution didn't investigate him from the beginning. Darren Rudier was thoroughly investigated from the get-go. Prosecutor Greg Davis stated that Darren was in fact their initial prime suspect. However, despite Darren's statements not making a lot of sense, and the possibility of him having a motive by collecting on a $250,000 life insurance policy, the forensic evidence at the scene simply did not link him to the actual murder. The supporters conclude that some sort of deal was made between Darren and Darlie's mother, Darlie Key, with defense attorney Doug Mulder, who in turn promised not to go after Darren. They're suggesting that the prosecution turned a blind eye to Darren and having to convict someone they just decided to hang the murders on Darlie. In other words, what the Darlie supporters are suggesting is that this was a well-orchestrated, well-coordinated conspiracy that included local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies, hospital employees, attorneys, paramedics, neighbors, and co-workers, all working together hand-in-hand to set up Darlie Rudier. And they never offer any reasons as to why all of these different people would want to do that and to perjure themselves. Mm-hmm. So that's quite a diatribe.
Yes, and he did actually include resources, too, where he got the information, but I didn't want you to have to read those because that's boring to listen to. But if anyone's interested, you can find those on, I believe it was on YouTube.
Okay. Well, all I'd say to this long letter from Brian is that I agree.
Yeah, but we were a little suspicious of Darren, weren't we? And
we
the
were.
Defense attorney?
We were.
Yeah.
But the evidence was such that it made it impossible for anyone else to have done it. To me.
Right. But maybe Darren knew something is what I thought.
He might have known something.
Yeah.
But the forensic evidence was just such a beautiful work by the investigators.
It's one of my favorite episodes of Forensic Files is the one they did on this case.
Right. And it just absolutely left no doubt in my mind that she did it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that he's made a lot of good points. He's probably right. But I do think Darren behaved strangely. Remember how Darren told the police about his wife's big boobs when his kids were dying on the floor?
Right.
Something wrong with that.
There is.
And he did have financial problems, so.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a little sketchy about him, but I definitely think that the forensic evidence proved that she did it.
I think so.
I mean, what about the video? I mean, I know we've talked about it several times, but the silly string video. Do you think that that was prejudicial against her?
I don't. Not at all.
No.
And even though they didn't show the memorial service beforehand.
Yeah, why didn't the defense show the memorial service beforehand? That's kind of goes with my whole suspicion about the defense attorney not really wanting to help her.
Well,
for Darren's sake.
Okay.
It's just a conspiracy
theory.
Now
you got your conspiracy theory going.
Well, I still think she did it.
Yeah, but I don't think the string video did that much harm.
Okay.
Even without the memorial service being shown with it.
Yeah, maybe it didn't in the case. I think with the public it probably did. Being on TV, it definitely turned people against her.
Yes.
That was a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe not so much in the actual case, which is the important part, I guess.
Right.
Okay, I have one last letter. It's an email from Linda, and it's about an officer and a psychotic. What? An officer.
An officer and a psychopath.
Yes, great title. So it's about that. And Linda says, it's possible that the interrogating officer used the phrase out of control, considering that William's major malfunction is his need to be in control. It may have been a way for the officer to increase William's paranoia and stress level by getting inside his head. Do you have a thought? I absolutely do. I think you're right.
Yeah.
I mean, the way he said things are getting out of control here, Russell. Definitely. I think that was a brilliant interrogation.
I do, too. And I think that really got Russell's attention.
Well, yeah, because once things are out of control, and he's at a loss.
We know how much he has to be in control.
Because he keeps trying to rein it in, and then once it gets past that part, he says, well, the only way I can control it now is just to do damage control.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, Linda, I definitely agree.
Then the whole story comes out.
Yeah.
So, you got it.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for the great feedback. I did go back a couple weeks to get some of these because it's one thing I have to always try and catch up on is the feedback. It builds up. But we'll be back with our next episode with more feedback. And we appreciate your listening and keep the feedback coming.
Keep it coming.
Yep. Okay. Goodbye, everybody. We'll see you at the quiet end.
Have a beer with us.